Second Coming by William Butler Yeats. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are filled with passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of spirit as moony troubles my sight. Somewhere in the sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless at the sun, is moving its slow thighs while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again. But now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. So have I scared you yet? Today is the first Sunday in Advent, the first day of the new year on the church calendar. Advent is the season of the year when we anticipate Christmas by waiting for the arrival of Christ. And it's traditional on the first Sunday of Advent to remember the second coming, a part of the Christian story that tends to make people like you and me nervous, because we are progressives. We are modern folk who are not into magical thinking. We have rejected the idea that a person can read the Bible and look in it for clues that can be used to unlock the mysteries around the great and glorious day in the fullness of time when Jesus is going to return with all the angels plus a few fiery horsemen of the apocalypse to open up a big sulfury can of whoop-ass on Satan and Madame Babylon and all their vile minions, plus anyone who ever chewed tobacco or cheated at Parcheesi or lingered with too much interest over the undergarment section of the Sears catalog. Not only that, but people like you and me are aware enough to know that over the years, any number of preachers, some of them were charlatans, others were well-meaning but misguided, any number of preachers have predicted the end of the world by paying close attention to the words of Scripture. And we know that in the minds of these people, well, not only were they wrong, but in the minds of these people, the forces of light always seem to march forth into the battle of Armageddon under the stars and stripes, while the armies of the Antichrist always fly the banner of the Kaiser or the swastika or the hammer and sickle or a big green flag with Arabic script on it or the flag of whatever nation or people we consider to be the enemy of the American dream. And when these folks aren't using the second coming as a jingoistic prop, they're using it to scare children. I don't know if you had the same kind of Sunday school teachers that I had, but when I was a kid, some of my Sunday school teachers read Hal Lindsey's book, The Late Great Planet Earth. And for reasons known only to them, they felt that end times prophecy was an appropriate subject to cover in a Sunday school room full of fourth graders. I remember riding home from church in the back seat of my family's VW microbus, watching the clouds over the Pacific Ocean, seeing if they were parting in a way that would allow Jesus to descend. And I was praying, "Oh Jesus, please don't come back till after I get my driver's license. I want to drive at least once." Dearly beloved, we are not the kind of Christian who reads the Bible looking for clues about the end of the world. We're not the kind of Christian who assumes Jesus is a good patriotic American. And we're not going to use the Bible to shame anyone or to scare children. You and I know that if the end of the world were close at hand, if Jesus were coming back tomorrow, All we'd really need to do is find a good bottle of champagne and a couple of glasses. So why do we even talk about the second coming? Well, I'm glad you asked. The first reason we talk about the second coming in church is because it's an issue that every American Christian eventually must address. Because no religious doctrine has shaped the American spiritual landscape more than the second coming. It is safe to say that American religion is infused with the apocalypse, because ever since the pilgrims sat shivering on the decks of the Mayflower off the coast of Cape Cod, listening to the first sermon preached in New England, which, by the way, was a sermon about the second coming, American Christianity has been obsessed with the return of Christ. Nearly all the religious traditions started in America have the second coming as an organizing principle. The Mormons, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Jehovah's Witnesses, even those strange New Agers who committed suicide as a way of hitching a ride on the Hale-Bopp Comet, all have been organized around the end of days. And even if you and I aren't into it, surely we have friends and relatives and co-workers and neighbors who are very American in that they share this obsession with Jesus' imminent return. In fact, as I wrote this sermon in a cafe in Mendocino, a couple was sitting at the table behind me and they were talking about Jesus' second coming. In American religion, the second coming is inescapable. And for that reason, it's important for people like you and me to know what the Bible's apocalyptic literature is really all about. And that leads me to the second reason we need to talk occasionally about the second coming. If the Bible isn't meant to be read as a way to find clues about the end of the world, then what are those strange parts of the Bible, like the one Pat read just now? What are they about? What's going on? Well, all of the biblical scholars that I admire are of the opinion that the Bible's apocalyptic literature was not written about the future. Rather, these parts of the Bible use poetic language to describe what was happening at the time they were written. So this morning's lesson for Mark uses figurative and freaky images to describe the Roman response to the Jewish revolts that happened in the middle of the first century. And Pat only read the tame parts. If you read the verses before that, it's really strange. The Romans responded violently to the Jewish rebellion. They sacked Jerusalem, they destroyed the temple, and they chased residents of Jerusalem out into the desert where those residents suffered severe hardship. That's what Jesus is talking about in this passage from Mark. The book of Revelation uses similar language to describe the early Roman repressions against Christians. And the Old Testament apocalyptic literature describes the violence of the Babylonian, Assyrian, and Persian empires. And in all of these passages, the ending is the same. God wins. Oppression ends. Light shines in the darkness. And despite all the evidence to the contrary, there is reason for hope and joy. Now, the genius of the Bible's apocalyptic literature is this. It is written in such a way that anytime you read it, you can look at the current events that are happening, and it will seem as if the Bible's prophecies are being fulfilled right now, in real time. You see, the Bible's apocalyptic literature is written like a fortune cookie, or like the daily horoscope in the newspaper. The language is so broad, and the imagery is so archetypal and universal that it always feels current and up to date. And that's why so many people end up reading the Bible like a book of magic. Sometimes it feels magic. But it is possible to read the apocalyptic literature as words of real hope without reading them superstitiously. And here's what I mean. When I wrote this sermon, as I mentioned earlier, I was sitting in a cafe in Mendocino. Outside it was raining, but I was dry. My belly was still full from the massive turkey dinner I'd eaten the day before in the presence of 22 members of my immediate and extended family. I had with me a nice warm cup of organic, fair trade, dark roasted, well-brewed coffee. And my biggest concern was the fact that I was being distracted by people who wouldn't stop talking about Jesus' second coming. And I tell you, my main concern was that I was afraid they'd come over to my table and ask what I was writing about. Then it would have been all over. When I was writing this sermon, I was comfortably enjoying everything from dry socks to the societal privileges afforded to straight white males. I had no need for a second coming. When I was writing this sermon, I was not a black man living in Ferguson, Missouri. When I wrote the sermon, I wasn't a gay man living in Uganda. I wasn't a woman living in Guatemala. I wasn't a Palestinian living in East Jerusalem. I wasn't a Jew living in Tehran. I wasn't a child from El Salvador sleeping on the cement floor of a Border Patrol detention center in Arizona. When I wrote these words, I didn't need a God who promises to come into the world to set things right. I'm lucky that way. And maybe you are too. But most of the world doesn't share our good fortune. Most of the world needs to be reminded that God is alive in the world, acting in human history, and preparing a comeback. And if you and I don't believe Jesus will come back descending on a cloud, then that only means that Jesus will return to the world as we bear Christ to the world. Jesus will be alive in places like Ferguson, Missouri, and Uganda, and Guatemala, and Palestine, and Iran, insofar as Jesus is alive in us and we go to those places. We are the ones through whom Christ returns to a world in need. That's the hope. The world can get better because Christ is alive in us and works through us. That is how Jesus returns. And that's what we're waiting for. We're waiting for Christ to come again by moving in us and through us. Now let me say one more thing about the second coming. I've been your pastor for 8.5 months now, and in that time I've spent a lot of time preaching on social justice and peacemaking and politics. It has made me so happy to be in a congregation where such issues are both welcome and expected from the pulpit. I felt like at times like a kid in a candy shop. But I'm going to get more traditionally pastoral for a moment and say this. What's true for the world in need of social change and justice and peace also is true for us as individuals whose needs are emotional and spiritual. Many of us whose physical needs are well met still need to feel the healing touch of a God who returns to us in real time. I don't know anyone who hasn't suffered from at least occasional bouts of regret and sadness. Everyone I know lays awake at night, at least sometimes, worrying about a loved one, or about the future, or about the balance in the checking account. We're human. We live with sadness and grief and disappointment. We have longings and hopes and secret fantasies. And the promise of Advent, the promise of the second coming, is as true for people like us as it is true for those whose lives are touched by societal injustice or violence or war or the terror of oppressive regimes or the devastations of famine and drought. The promise of Advent is that God is alive in the world, moving among us with the healing touch of grace. And if we don't believe Jesus will return sometime in the future in a literal sense, then it becomes our work to be Christ for one another, to reach out to one another, to support one another, to speak words of healing to each other, to live together in ways that bring healing and strength and hope. That is how Christ will return among us, to heal us and to strengthen us. Come, Lord, quickly. So my challenge to you is this. Live an apocalyptic faith, not because you're waiting for Christ to return, but because in your faithfulness, Christ is returning through you to transform a world in need of justice and peace. And in your relationships closer to home, may Christ return through you as you live lives that are manifestations of hope and peace and joy and God's healing grace. Amen.